Yesterday, it was my honor to be invited with a lot of other media people to the media preview of the new DIA exhibit, Detroit Institute of Arts exhibit, Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus. It opens to the public on Sunday. It runs through February the 12th. But friends, don't wait until February 12th to go see this exhibit. It is fascinating. I learned so much. Not only from the brief lectures that I heard prior to them opening the exhibit to the media, but also through the exhibit itself. It's a self-guided tour. You can take an audio tour if you like, but you can also just read what they've how they've set this thing up. And I learned so much about Rembrandt, and his paintings are absolutely beautiful. And on the other end of our phone line is Curator Emeritus at the Detroit Institute of Arts, George Kies, and he, of course, is heading up this exhibit out there at the DIA. And Mr. Kies, it's an honor to welcome you here to the Paul Edwards program.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
I always assumed, and I guess this is the fault of me not paying attention in junior high school, but I always assumed that Rembrandt would have been Catholic, like so many of the great painters were, and influenced by the Catholic Church. But when I heard you say yesterday at the DIA that he was born in Leiden and lived in Amsterdam for most of his life, before you ever had to say anything more, my thought was he had to have been influenced by Dutch Calvinism.
Yes, that would absolutely be the case. He was literate. His father was a miller, but the family indeed was educated, and his mother, we have every reason to believe, was rather a pious woman. And as far as I know, the family actually was mainline Calvinist. Rembrandt himself never actually was enrolled at a specific church, so it's really unclear, you know, which vein of Protestantism he was most sympathetic to. He varied enormously in terms of the number of sitters he painted, and we know their denominations. And it's interesting because a number of these people, particularly those he painted shortly after his move to Amsterdam, were in fact Mennonites. And that was a much more liberal strain of Protestantism than, say, sort of mainline Calvinism of the period. And in Holland, you'll always sense that there's kind of a struggle between the determination of the Calvinist divines to impose a very strict kind of a puritanical order on society, and the willingness of the regent class, however, to loosen things up and allow for a greater sense of religious toleration. Rembrandt certainly, I would say, was more inclined towards religious toleration, which is what makes his investigation into Christian subject matter, I think, so very sympathetic, because, I mean, he allows for such a range of interpretation, and one that invites the person viewing the work of art to really think about, shall we say, the compassionate strain of Christianity.
In the providence of God, Rembrandt is born in Leiden, if I'm pronouncing the name of the city correctly, and feel free to correct me on these pronunciations when I get them wrong, but he's born there in the Dutch Republic, and in your brief lecture yesterday, Mr. Kies, you pointed out that there were political economic circumstances in the Dutch Republic and in Amsterdam in particular that really created kind of a perfect environment for Rembrandt to thrive in his work.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. A colleague of mine in another context was saying that really you have to think of Amsterdam in the 17th century as being like a city like New York or London would be today. It's a city that is so diverse in the communities represented, and is a kind of a laboratory at fever pitch of avant-garde cultural experimentation. That you have to think of Amsterdam as a city that, within the constraints of 17th century society, was very, very open, and quite frankly also very open-minded relative to the rest of the Dutch Republic, which most certainly was more conservative.
When I was just in Amsterdam for a couple of days in July on my way back from Kyiv, And you talk about the restraints of the 17th century on the open society of Amsterdam. Those restraints have definitely been removed. I mean, I got off the train at the main station there downtown to begin an evening stroll through the city of Amsterdam, and was immediately met by the wafting aroma of marijuana.
If it
had open restraint in the 17th century, how would a modern Amsterdam compare with Rembrandt's Amsterdam?
There were definitely far more social constraints that would have existed within the 17th century. I think that the pervading impact of religion on people in general was such that people behaved there with a very clearly understood proper sense of demeanor. Their whole relationship in terms of their public life was one of, I would say, very constrained social patterns. The whole way of negotiating with other people was something that was done following, you know, very close social guidelines. And quite frankly, it's interesting because in many respects, I think that's still very true of society in the Netherlands. That it's interesting with the language of Dutch. There's very much, nonetheless, a correct way of saying things even today. So that I think that the public display of a sense of decorum and propriety is something that would have been very, very evident for people who were, as it were, involved in public engagement in Amsterdam in the 17th century. And you can certainly sense that in the paintings that were produced and all of the prints and drawings that were produced. If you look at, for example, the great city views of Jan van der Heijden or the Berkheide brothers, you can see people crossing the town square in Amsterdam. You can see people negotiating at the stock exchange in Amsterdam. You can see people at church listening to a preacher. The sense of decorum is very, very evident. Dress was something that people spent a great deal of time thinking about. Dress was actually a very complicated social ritual in the 17th century. Remember all of those ladies wearing millstone ruffs and starched lace. I mean, all of this was all to project a proper sense of decorum. So I think what made Amsterdam liberal in the 17th century was the willingness of the regent class to allow a wide range of diverse cultural activity or even ethnic groups to operate within the city. But they were not given carte blanche to operate just the way they felt. There's no question, for example, that the Jewish community of Amsterdam, they were not allowed to build a synagogue as determined by the regent class until they had been well established. And the great synagogues of Amsterdam were not built until the second half of the 17th century, even though you had large and active Jewish communities within the city.
Mr. George Kies is my guest. He is emeritus curator at the DIA and a curator of, forgive me if I'm not describing it correctly, visiting curator, guest curator of the new exhibit, Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus. It opens on Sunday, November 20th, and runs through February the 12th out at the Detroit Institute of Arts downtown in the Cultural Center there. And we encourage you to learn more about it at DIA.org is where you can get more information about the DIA and the Rembrandt exhibit. You mentioned the Jewish community there. There really was an amalgam of sorts of religious environments there in Amsterdam. And of course, we've talked a bit about the Dutch Reformed or the Calvinistic influence on Rembrandt. But he, my understanding is, he lived in the Jewish community. And am I correct? Do I have the right information that he is the first of the artists to portray Jesus as a Jewish male and used a young Jewish model, a young Jewish male, to sit for that portrait?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. that it would appear because of these wonderful two chalk drawings that Rembrandt did, plus the series of painted heads of Christ, that these are all based on the same model. Now, whether all the painted heads of Christ are by Rembrandt or other members of his studio is something that remains to be established. But the fact of the matter is that Rembrandt encouraged this really transformative development in the image of Jesus, and it had an enormous impact on his own art at the time, as seen in the two masterpieces in the exhibition, the Supper at Emmaus of 1648 from the Louvre, this wonderful panel painting, and then a superb impression of the 100 Guilder print, otherwise known as Christ Healing the Sick or Christ Preaching to the People. And this transformative representation of Jesus as based on a young male Jewish figure drawn from the community, Jewish community of Amsterdam, was something that would continue to reverberate through the imagination of Christians right up to our own time, and surely will continue to do so.
When you consider the sum of Rembrandt's work, what percentage of it would be connected biblically with biblical references?
Actually, a very large percentage. If one looks at his prints in particular and many of the drawings, I would say it would certainly be somewhere between 30% and 40%. One has to remember that Rembrandt needed to paint portraits. They were his bread and butter. But, I mean, his real passion was for representing history subjects, and most of these indeed were drawn from the Bible. And it's just clear from the way he did drawings again and again and again of the same subject, and these wonderful prints also representing the same theme, so that he was he really sought an extraordinary sense of meaning by his searching investigation of these religious subjects.
Of course, the Calvinists of the 16th and 17th centuries, Mr. Keyes, would certainly have an aversion to images. They would have the exact opposite feeling as the Catholic Church, which is certainly known for its iconoclastic worship. You go into a Protestant church, as you well know, or certainly a Calvinistic church, and you can barely find a cross. So did Rembrandt consult with Protestant theologians, Calvinistic theologians, as he began his work of imaging Jesus Christ and these particular biblical scenes, most of which are from the New Testament?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and the answer, I guess, I would have to say is yes, but indirectly. I would say that for the Calvinist divines, they really believed that the truth existed in the Word of the Bible. And so the idea of listening to a minister preach would be the primary means of conveying a sense of spiritual revelation and truth. But what's interesting is that we know that Rembrandt had a copy of what is known as the Staten Bible, or the Dutch Official States Bible. Now, the Dutch Official States Bible was really created by a group of Calvinist divines, in other words, theologians. And one of the features of this Bible is the fact that throughout it is absolutely filled with annotations which elucidate the meanings of the scriptures themselves. And so it's this notion that the Word can convey religious truths is really central to Calvinism. But of course, if you're a visual artist, I suppose you're going to have to interpolate all of this into visual imagery, which is exactly what Rembrandt did.
His depiction of biblical scenes, is it for his and I'm asking you now to be part a psychiatrist, I guess, or psychologist, to get into the head of Rembrandt as you've observed his work and the progression of it. His depiction of biblical scenes, his fixation on the face of Jesus, is it cathartic for him? Is it a spiritual thing for him, or is it a tutorial? Is he trying to use the gift that God gave him to further the message of the New Testament, the message of the Bible, to maybe illiterate people of his day?
Well, I think that Rembrandt's investigation of these subjects was largely driven by his own very specific individual interest in the Bible. He clearly was well versed in any number of biblical accounts, and I think that what makes Rembrandt very special here is that his own investigation, which surely served his own individual spiritual needs, was something that he also saw as a vehicle by which other people could have the same experience. And one of the things that I find really remarkable about Rembrandt is that I think that there is a very, very strong sense of the humility of Jesus, the humbleness of this figure, the sense of ongoing pervading goodness of this figure. And I think Rembrandt saw in New Testament imagery in particular, that he was able to create a sense of compassion and a sense of what I would call not only the need for goodness in the world, but the recognition that it actually exists. But it's something that's inward. It's something that he encourages people to extract from their own essential selves. And I think that what you get with Rembrandt's images of or interpretations of these subjects is really a revelation of his own sense of his own internal self as it really boils up to the surface. And it's something that because of his extraordinarily compassionate interpretation of these subjects, it's something that just has this extraordinary universal appeal, which it's had over time. And it's really, it's that unique kind of narrative skill of this artist to convey a sense of compassion and goodness despite so many aspects of human nature, which have had very deleterious consequences over the course of human history.
Toward the end of your exhibit at the DIA, Rembrandt and the face of Jesus, there is a, I don't know, I didn't time it, but it's a considerable length, 5 to 8 minutes, I guess, of comparing the events, the circumstances of Rembrandt's life at individual periods of his life, and then showing what the product of his work was in that period. Rembrandt had a very difficult life. He had 4 children, I think, 3 of whom died in infancy. Titus, the only one to live to adulthood, and he dying very early, and his father outliving him. He had a wife that died. He had his financial issues. How did the particular circumstances of any given period of Rembrandt's life affect what it was, how he was expressing himself in his paintings concurrent with that period?
Well, I think that he's an artist who, as a younger man, was exceedingly ambitious, and there's no question that he financially overextended himself, and he did this knowingly. And it all came home to roost in a way that was going to have huge constraining consequences on his life. And I think so the fact that he had to declare bankruptcy, he had to see this collection of his that he had put together scattered to the winds, would have been a very painful experience for him. But I think that he had already sustained such a great sense of personal loss that I think the material loss that he experienced in the 1650s was probably less hard to bear than the personal loss that I think he had suffered during the late 1630s and 1640s. And I think all of this caused him to really pause and really rethink what his role was as an artist in representing this kind of subject matter. And I think that's really the primary reason I think that his art becomes much more meditative and quiet and ruminative, because I think that he himself, is basically using the art as it were to take time out from all of the vicissitudes of life that he had experienced, and that the art becomes a vehicle for a much greater, more serene sense of fulfillment. It's fulfillment that's both intellectual, but it's also a fulfillment that's definitely spiritual. And the fact that it appeals to people that way suggests to me that this is something that Rembrandt truly, passionately wanted to share with other people. I think his late self-portraits are absolutely remarkable because they show the visage of a worn but highly intelligent human being who is really representing himself, because I think he's trying to search, you know, what he sees as essential to his very existence on Earth, and is not flattering himself at all. But yeah, I mean, the interesting thing with all of this is that even after experiencing financial vicissitudes and falling considerably out of favor, and I stress he never fell completely out of favor, and it's important to stress that, Rembrandt recognized that people recognized his image. But what I think is wonderful about it is that he's so honest about his image, that if people were still interested in late Rembrandt, that's fine. But he was representing himself as a you know, a worn person whose sagging flesh really also showed the, as it were, the ruthless passage of time.
When you, George Kies, walk through your exhibit there, Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus, and the several masterpieces of Rembrandt's that you have on display there at the DIA for the next several weeks, is there any particular masterpiece that you find yourself drawn to more than others?
Yeah, I have to say that the painting that the Louvre lent for the exhibition, which is really the whole anchor of the exhibition to me, is a picture that just continues to haunt me. It's haunted me even when I was a young student, and every time I've come back to it, I've always seen something more remarkable in this work. And I do find that there's just there's such a depth of meaning that Rembrandt is plumbing by searching his searching investigations of the subject over and over again. But I think that the painting in Paris is absolutely one of the masterpieces of the 17th century, one of Rembrandt's supreme achievements. And to my mind, the thing about it that I just love more than anything else, it's the larger world writ small. The whole thing is painted on such a diminutive scale that it projects the whole thing directly into the realm of the individual beholder, that the individual is really treated as the important person who's looking at this picture. And each one of us who can look at this picture in the exhibition, you will think to yourself, this is my painting.
Mm-hmm.
It's mine and mine alone as I'm looking at it. It gives back so much to me. And even if there are 75 million people looking at this painting in the exhibition, which would be nice, it's still going to be your own individual picture.
It was a spiritual experience for me to walk through there. There may have been, I don't know, 50 or so media people walking through the exhibit yesterday, but it was a very quiet spiritual experience for me to walk through. And for me, the Crown of Thorns was my picture, because I'm absolutely taken by the fact that I have a Savior who would bear in my place. The old hymn, "In my place condemned he stood," came to mind when I looked on that painting. And I'm wondering if that, and to hear you answer the question before I had the opportunity to ask it, Mr. Kies, it seems that is really what can be expected when we look upon a Rembrandt, that there will be one that will kind of uncover your heart and you will readily identify with it in a very unexplainable spiritual sense.
I think that's absolutely the case, and it's what makes this artist such a magnet. It's why he has had an international reputation, not only in his lifetime, but centuries and centuries and centuries thereafter, that we ourselves are still plumbing the depths of meaning that these images that Rembrandt created, you know, offer to us.
Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus. The exhibit opens at the Detroit Institute of Arts this coming Sunday. It runs through February the 12th. You can get more information on the exhibit at dia.org, and I encourage you to do that. We'll get information linked at our website at godandculture.com. And Mr. George Kies, it has been an absolute personal privilege for me to have this conversation with you.
Well, thank you very much for including me, and we certainly all wish well for the exhibition here in Detroit.